How should a leader manage the sustainability function of a business in an effective manner? Krisa Pagitsis, author of Chief Sustainability Officers at Work, joins Darden Professor Mike Lennox for a conversation about the challenges sustainability leaders often face and the approaches that allow for effective change within organizations on this episode of Leadership Unscripted.
It is absolutely a thrill to have with us one of Darden's illustrious alumni, Krisa Pagitsis. And I hope I pronounced that close to right. I've known Krisa for years, and I was saying I always struggle with her Greek last name.
I will take you to Greece, and then you'll be a pro.
Well, I appreciate that. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, and Krisa has done some amazing work, both as a practitioner, but now as an author as well. She is a keynote speaker. She is an advisor to corporate leaders and to board members on topics around ESG and corporate sustainability. She has a new book out, Corporate Sustainability Officers at Work. We're going to talk a little bit about that this evening. And before that, she herself was a chief sustainability officer, serving as the head of ESG for Fannie Mae. And amongst many of her accomplishments, I think the one that sticks out the most is helped raise a $50 billion green fund investment through Fannie Mae, largest in the world. So really a true pioneer and leader in green bonds. Maybe we'll take a little time to talk about as well. So once again, we're going to be using our time here to talk a little bit about chief sustainability officers, but also to talk a little more just about leadership in general and how you might lead in this ESG space. Maybe I'll ask her how to define that at some point or not. We can debate. But just to start off, Krisa, just share with us your journey. How did you get involved in this area? Where does the passion maybe come from, and where puts you where you are today?
Thank you, Mike, and thank you everybody virtually and in person for coming. It is really an honor to be here representing Darden as a Darden alum and talking about my work. You know, I did not know about sustainability when I graduated college over 20 years ago. It was a field. It's been around for over 30 years, maybe even 40 years, I could argue. But it certainly was not something that was taught at school, and certainly not in the way that we teach it today. So my undergrad degree is actually in international relations. It's not in this space. But when I graduated, I wanted to be in an international forum environment. And so the best place for me to go, in my mind, was a consulting firm, which is what I did. And they put me in the energy group. That's how it all started. And what ended up happening is by working with energy companies, looking at some really exciting things, which I find exciting, energy price forecasting, I started exploring a new area that was disrupting the utilities industry in the early 2000s, which is renewable energy, mass scale renewable energy like solar panels, and then thinking about things like green building. So my career shifted from billing energy, thinking about commercial building prices and their energy usage, to how do we actually get energy prices to go down? How do we actually get utility bills to go down through green buildings? So I started working for large companies that were trying to figure that out. And eventually in 2010, so fast forwarding a decade, landed at Fannie Mae to build a green initiative, a green thing that ended up being the green bond business.
Tell us a little bit more about your time at Fannie Mae. Maybe for those who don't know, maybe just explain who Fannie Mae is, because
sure.
It is a really interesting organization. And then, of course, the work you did do with the green bond work.
So Fannie Mae is an entity in the United States. It's called a GSE, a government-sponsored enterprise, and it serves as a secondary mortgage lender. So without getting into the weeds of mortgages which again, I find exciting. In the United States, we have primary lenders like Wells Fargo and PNC, and then we have somebody like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which is a secondary lender supporting the primary lenders and circulating funds and money so that we, as American homeowners and renters, have places to live affordably. So their role is mortgages and also then securitizing those mortgages into bonds.
So tell me now, what is a green bond and why Fannie Mae would get involved with something like this?
So when we think about a mortgage, it's a mortgage that we have on single family homes and condos, but it's also something that we have on multifamily buildings, so apartment buildings, right? Many of us either grew up, like myself, in an apartment building, lived in an apartment building, and it's actually a really important housing stock in the United States. My work was figuring out how do you green apartment buildings? How do you make them more affordable through energy efficiency, water efficiency? So when I built the green mortgage business, what it really meant was convincing owners, commercial owners who have large portfolios of these buildings, to make choices that make their properties more energy efficient. So things like energy efficient lighting, things like heating and ventilation systems that are more energy efficient, new windows, new doors, insulation. Again, you'll see a theme here in my career, Mike, which is technical things, maybe not very sexy, but man, do they have a big impact on the environment.
No, I mean, I do this work on decarbonization, and the built environment is a large emitter of greenhouse gases, even just what we would call scope one, so emissions from the buildings themselves,
right.
Not to mention the electrical generation and electrical use that we see in buildings there. And it's a tough one, I imagine, because you're talking about often already built stock, and how do you retrofit it?
That's
so
right.
How does the bonds help with the retrofit?
So these commercial owners, and that's the work that I did, is commercial owners or nonprofits that own properties, right? It's not a mom and pop operation, mm-hmm. right? It's how do you convince somebody who has been operating a building every day for the last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years to make changes that are more energy efficient? So the change that I had to make and I built with my team is a mortgage that incentivized them to consider when they were getting a refinance or they were acquiring a property, hey, maybe now is the time to put in that energy efficient HVAC. Maybe now is the time to put in those new windows. And when they made that decision to do that, that's what made it a green mortgage. And mortgages are behind bonds, and that is what becomes a mortgage-backed security, or in the area of multifamily, it's commercial real estate, so it's commercial mortgage-backed securities. And that is what a green bond is. It's a security backed by a green mortgage, backed by a green property.
Everybody got this so far?
I hope so. It's absolutely an exciting part, I think, of our economy. But maybe, Mike, I could actually just take it down a little bit. When I think about the work that I did with my team at Fannie Mae, yes, it was underwriting and asset management and securitization, capital markets. But at the end of the day, what it really was having this kind of conversation, one-on-one with developers and owners to get them to say yes. Yes to doing something new that they hadn't done before. And oftentimes in these conversations, the answer was no. Why should I change? Why should I change the way I've been operating my business? And I really had to put myself in their shoes and figure out what would get them to yes. And I think that is the part when we think about sustainability and we think about integrating sustainability into business that many people forget about. They think mostly about the product, the technical thing, how can it be renewable, how can it be recyclable. A lot about sustainability integration is how do you get to yes? And that's about change management, that's about communications, that's about stakeholder engagement.
So I'm curious on that note.
Yeah.
How much is it selling the world is falling apart, we have climate change and you need to make a change, or is it sold more on maybe the economic argument, or are there other arguments that you tried to bring to bear to convince people to do this?
No, it's not bringing in immediately the carbon reductions or the environmental, to be candid. That doesn't mean that some audiences don't want to hear about it. Some do. But when I would have these conversations, it was by reducing your energy bill, you increase your net operating income, and that increases your valuation. Mike, why would you leave money on the table by not being more energy efficient? It's that simple. Mike, you're leaving money on the table. Aren't you a smart developer? Aren't you a smart commercial property owner?
So you've been at this for a while now.
Sure.
You mentioned I've been at it even longer because I remember back, when we just talk about environmental health and safety officials.
Yeah, EHS, and
there was no chief sustainability officers. I could imagine, though, talking about even your work before Fannie Mae,
mm-hmm.
How there was efforts for solar and renewable energy. But to be honest, back 20 years ago, the economics weren't there, right?
Yeah. And
even on the built environment, those products have been around for a while. The case is getting stronger and stronger. But again, going back in time, wasn't necessarily there. How have you managed maybe that transition and that evolution that we've seen?
So for context, in 2000, there was a milestone in the solar industry. The world passed 1 gigawatt of energy production through solar. Today, it's over 900, right? So huge change there. In 2000, the first LEED building was built in Annapolis. 23 years ago now, we've got over 100,000 buildings. Those early buildings, and even today, or even any innovation that requires sustainability, truthfully does require a first mover that is willing to take a leap of faith. I'm not going to gloss over that there are costs, that there are new technologies that have yet to be proven, but somewhere along the line, early on, somebody said, you know what, I see the potential here, and I'm going to lead. And I do think that that's what it takes to move the needle forward in this space, is finding the people who are willing to take leaps of faith, willing to be brave, willing to experiment, and frankly, willing to fail, but learn. I do believe that. I have a story, if you don't mind.
No, please go ahead. So, I think these are critical points about the ability to learn.
So, you know, I consider the growth of the portfolio that I claim to be $50 billion, $51 billion from 2010 to 2018. And then in 2019, I handed the reins over to my team. I became the head of ESG, and then they doubled it. So actually, the portfolio of Fannie Mae today is over $100 billion issued in green bonds, right? So huge milestone there. How many products do you think that we iterated before we figured out on the ones that got us to that first $50 billion?
Hundreds.
Okay, not hundreds.
I'm just thinking, you know, this is...
Three.
Three.
Oh. At least three. So at least three iterations.
Okay.
One of the products, we only did one loan in. One loan for $800,000. Hmm. So at an organization like Fannie Mae, where its entire portfolio, including single family and multifamily, is over $3 trillion. $800,000 is a rounding error. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even make it onto a graph, right? So I could have thought of it as a failure, and technically it was. It failed to generate volume. Where it succeeded was teaching us and our team and the larger underwriting team and asset managers and originators, the ecosystem was, it was too complicated. No one knew how to do the energy audit. Loan originators, the front end, the salespeople, could not explain the benefits in 30 seconds or less. Hmm. Got to do it in 30 seconds. So it was by failing that we actually succeeded, and we built the next iterations that actually generated the volume, and the hockey stick went like this. So coming back to your original question, Mike, yes, there are costs to be innovative, but if you don't innovate and you don't fail, if you don't expect to fail, you're never going to succeed in any business, sustainability or not. I'm a firm believer of that.
So I'm curious, as a leader, how you overcome the natural resistance to this. I do a lot of work with companies where I talk about, you know, fail fast, you know, iterate quickly and learn. And invariably, you know, they struggle with even fail once, right? You know, they know they need to do this, but at some level, this is kind of reaction that, hey, you know, we can't tolerate we can't tolerate failure in our organization. So how'd you convince either Fannie Mae or others that you work with to kind of adopt that learning mindset?
So I think, you know, it was interesting. I was listening to your question, and as you were saying it, companies are 1,000 people, 100,000 people, or they're 50, and they're a big monolithic they. To get the entire company to say yes, it actually is figuring out what the person either in charge or holding the money or somebody who has the most to win from something, what matters to them to get them to say yes. And I find that when we break an organization down and we do some very detailed leadership mapping. You start thinking about, the CFO cares about 1, 2, 3, and it may not just be the proxy, it may not just be, you know, the investors, they do care about that, but they also have personal ambitions, personal interests, personal priorities. So you gotta think about that. And as you work through the organization, you start figuring out what would make the person say yes, not in any sort of devious or nefarious way, Mike, I promise, but in a true stakeholder alignment.
I hear this a lot. You know, you hear the CEO who, you know, started their sustainability journey because their, you know, child was harassing about, like, Dad, or Mom, what are you doing about this this issue? Well, let's move on to the book, because, you know, you have your personal experiences, but you did this amazing book where you collected, I think it was 25, is that correct? 25 different chief sustainability officers' stories and journeys and lessons learned, really, at the end of the day. First, maybe I am going to ask the hard question, not of the defined sustainability, but can you help us define what exactly is a chief sustainability officer? And I'll just note that if you look through the titles of the various people summarized in the book or interviewed in the book, it's all over the map. Yeah. There's people with communications in their title, stakeholder, ESG responsibility, HR, a lot of different angles by which people are getting into this area. So what's the common denominator for these individuals?
Sure. The common denominator is they are the most senior executive officer in their company responsible for the sustainability and ESG strategy for their company. That was my primary focus, which is that most senior executive. The person sitting on the C-suite, if not the C-suite, they are reporting to the C-suite, right? So titles were challenging because the CSO role does exist, and there are a handful of people that have it, but there's CSOs, there's chief impact officer, there's chief sustainability and strategy officers, and then there's managing directors, more commonly used in the financial services space. But the common denominator, aside from the C-suite and their representation at the most senior levels, is that they are responsible for driving opportunities at their company through sustainability and managing risk, right? So what they're thinking about is, how does thinking about carbon, how does thinking about social issues, how does thinking about governance end up making the company stronger by either finding new revenue opportunities or by mitigating risk? That's what I would define as actually a chief sustainability officer, head of ESG. They're driving those two ends of that spectrum.
Now tell me, I would imagine that that risk management piece is a challenge because you probably don't directly manage the functions that maybe are creating the risk or mitigating the risk.
Right.
And this is true of a lot of kind of corporate level functions that you're dealing with, again, potentially a large complex organization. So how do you navigate between that assignment and maybe a little bit of a lack of control directly on those risks?
So I think the CSO role, and by the way, I will use that term as the umbrella term because it's...
Because it would be way too long for you to lay out all these different possibilities.
I think the CSO role, from both my experience and then interviewing my peers, is that it is a unique role where it rarely drives revenue directly. Mm-hmm. And it also rarely is touching, owning expenses directly. It influences both, but it rarely owns it. Yeah. So to answer your question, similar with the risk, right? CSOs and their teams don't own the full risk management, but they need to influence all the people that are managing risk in order to capture it. So whether that's working with the CFO and their team and looking at the investor relations sides, that's one piece. It's working with audit and making internal audit and making sure that the audit teams are understanding how environmental and social risks touch every part of the business. And it's thinking about the risk of not doing anything, not addressing climate change, and how do you manage that, and how do you educate people on the risk of not addressing climate change. So CSOs as leaders and their teams very much do a lot of influencing and education. They may not do directing and have the immediate ability to say, do this and do it now.
So let's take a deep dive on the climate risk one that obviously I'm very interested in, you are as well. when I think of climate risk and when I look at a lot of companies, I think there's been an awakening to climate risk from the direct physical implications of climate on their business and potential operations. But when I think about where maybe the greatest risks are, it's going to be more in the, either the social arena, the license to operate, maybe their supply chains, maybe transition risks that arise as we see this kind of massive change in a variety of industries towards more clean technology. How far along do you find most organizations are in this more kind of expansive assessment of climate risk?
So I think CSOs and heads of ESG within global companies are very aware of both the physical risk and the transition risk, meaning physical assets, things being destroyed by climate change, and then also business and license to operate, the transition risk if they don't act. So the CSOs that I interviewed included US-based companies or with primary businesses like MGM Resorts International, so Las Vegas, right, Jyoti Chopra, but also included Amazon, Kara Hurst, global operations, to companies like Ernst & Young, global operations, global clientele, who they are advising. And then BlackRock, Procter & Gamble, and Coca-Cola. So a huge range of companies. The CSOs that are at the forefront, and I would argue all of these are thinking about both, because I think a fundamental key role for a CSO is looking into the future. It's not about this year's activities, it's looking about what is going to impact the company in 5 years and 10 years. And it's very clear from the science and data that unless CSOs and their companies are thinking about physical risk and transition risk, their companies may not exist in just a few years.
You mentioned Amazon. We're sitting a stone's throw away from Amazon HQ2 here in Northern Virginia. They're a really interesting company for a variety of reasons.
Sure.
Huge footprint, not only from a sustainability standpoint, but just in terms of their impact on society. From a chief sustainability officer standpoint, how do you even begin to get your hands around the E, S, and G, which can go in so many directions, environmental, but also social, digital technologies, the impact of AI? They're on the forefront of all of this here. How do you manage that?
So I had the pleasure of interviewing Kara Hurst, who leads sustainability, worldwide sustainability at Amazon. And just as a piece, you know, Mike, when I wrote this book, it was to pull back the curtain on how do you lead? How do you lead in this global context on some complex issues? And Kara, to her credit, said, I trust my team. I have a global team with deep expertise in each of those issues that you mentioned that she relies on in order to pull in information, engage with the businesses, plural, because Amazon has many businesses, and then synthesize what's the best way forward for Amazon, its suppliers, and its customers. So I really emphasize that when you're a leader, any leader, not just a sustainability leader, being able to trust your team to do their job and have the expertise makes your work more impactful, more powerful, and frankly, more bearable, because you can't be everywhere at once and in every single meeting, right? So I think that's a key piece. She trusts her team, and her team is technically technical experts and bring back information.
So let's talk a little bit about the external piece. And what I'm thinking about this is how companies, in particular CSOs, have to navigate that interface with the broader set of stakeholders that companies face. And I'll just make one observation, which is, I think, going back 30, 40 years ago, especially around environmental issues, you had your large NGOs, environmental activist groups and the like, who might target companies and companies would respond and the like. We live in a day and an age right now where arguably two people, a clever idea that goes viral on TikTok can cause irreparable damage to a brand or to a company's identity. Is this keeping CSOs up late at night, or how do you manage that kind of external piece of the puzzle?
Well, I think the CSOs, again, and I was looking at a very particular global, high-profile, well-known brands, right? So I think of Procter & Gamble, right? So Virginia Elias, the CSO there, started out in the brand space, and then she ended up, because of her passion and watching Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, shifted her career over 30 years to become the CSO now for over 10 years. And I would say that in talking with Virginie, her work very much is thinking about Procter & Gamble's brand, but she is a master at welcoming in feedback. She's a master at bringing in internal partners as well as bringing external partners. They have alliances with nonprofits and NGOs. They have alliances with their peers and competitors in order to bring in information that'll influence the sustainability space. And internally, she shared with me, and that's captured in the chapter, about how she worked with Lisa Jennings, the Head & Shoulders brand owner, the brand strategist and owner of the Head & Shoulders business, to launch an entirely new bottle that changed so many people's opinions internally because it used recycled plastic in a way that hadn't been done before. So I think my point here is, you know, Mike, there will be critics, full stop. What I saw in Virginie, what I had in my own experience at Fannie Mae is, how do you make the critics partners to actually get you to a better solution? So I don't think companies should be afraid of the critics. I think they should be aware and be ready to engage and ask questions and see what they can learn from it. That's brave leadership to me. It's about being engaged. It's not about defensive with closed doors.
So we're seeing somewhat the politicization of ESG right now. There's been a lot of backlash from certain quarters about, if you call it a movement, the whole movement.
Sure.
It seems like Disney and the governor of Florida are in the news almost daily these days going at one another. Again, keeping it from the CSO's perspective, how do you navigate this type of world where you have the same political divisions in our country that are kind of everywhere now really coming into this space as well?
So I think you have to take the long view. I don't think you can be in a senior role and not take the long view. So what I mean by that is, yes, you need to be aware of the forces that are pushing against your current work, so anti-ESG, and the movement to either eradicate it or not have it be a consideration, for example, for state treasurers. At the same time, CSOs need to be thinking about the future. How are their 10,000, 50,000 employees that work at the organization ready to be a part of the sustainability strategy? How are they, do they have the skills so that every job, no matter what their seat, is a green job? So anti-ESG movement is happening, it's real, but I think thinking about the future, one, keeps the CSO stable, and then two, coming back to those partnerships that I mentioned earlier. If you've got partners, state, local level, NGOs, nonprofits, and you've actually built alliances before this moment, you're actually in a good space because you've got allies who can influence in ways that maybe you can't directly. And that sort of, I think, will help in the long term change the tide away from the anti-ESG movement.
We've talked a lot about, you know, those various stakeholders. We've talked about managing kind of throughout the organization,
sure,
building coalitions of the willing, trying to convince those who maybe are skeptics. There's a couple examples in the book, and I imagine in your experience, of, you know, what about the leadership above you? You know, what if the senior, like the board of directors or the CEO, he or she doesn't maybe fully buy in to some of these efforts? What can you do as a leader in an organization?
So I'll be candid. It will happen. It is going to happen. I think there are companies that are at the forefront of sustainability. Many of them are publicly traded. They have to think about new SEC regulations, for example, coming out about climate reporting. But many, many, many organizations are privately held and are not subject to that pressure, which means that they are led by people who may not necessarily always have sustainability at the forefront because of regulatory pressure.
I always say, you know, people talk about privatization and Patagonia. Like, for every Patagonia, there's companies that aren't Patagonia.
Thousands, millions, millions. So some context setting, right? So it is going to happen. I think the question is going to be, when you're faced with that CEO, that C-suite, or that board whose answer is either skepticism or no, it is very much going to be grounding yourself in the business, right? So no one said Fannie Mae, or Fannie Mae said, you know, no directly to me, but I had to figure out, well, why is a green mortgage better? Why? Because lowering energy and water costs increases net operating income, which then means that payments that go to the mortgage and the investor more secure. It means capital improvements are being made in the property, which means it's a better quality property. It's gonna last longer. And then third, it means that the tenants are paying less for their energy and water bills, which means hopefully they have a more stable source of disposable income, not only for rent, but also for education, healthcare, transportation, groceries, things that matter. That simple argument, which I hope I made in 30 seconds or less, is what I would expect anybody who's thinking about sustainability takes to their leadership, no matter what their industry is. So wonderful. That's what I would say.
One more question before I open it up.
Sure.
This is a series on leadership.
Yeah.
What lessons did you learn, either from your personal experience or from writing the book and interviews, that go beyond sustainability and ESG, just generally good principles for leadership that you've seen from the CSOs you've interviewed?
Yeah. So I do strongly, strongly think that all leaders, regardless of their level, so when I say level, I mean seniority in the organization, do need to think about partnerships. Internal partnerships, external partnerships. So who are you going to be relying on to help you figure out a problem? My internal partnerships was with the legal department, for example. I needed to work.
That's actually surprising to me.
Are you kidding?
Because the legal, I thought, always tells you no to everything, right? So that's
for everybody here and on the joining us virtually, the legal department has to be your best friend. And I mean that sincerely, because they are problem solvers when the information is put in the context that they understand, and then barriers can be removed. So you need to build partnerships internally. And this is whatever your role is, sustainability or not, build internal partnerships and figure out external partnerships. I think another key lesson that I've learned, and I learned it the hard way, I will say, is know when to push the pedal down, whether on your gas vehicle or your EV vehicle, when to push for something and when to ease off. And that's really hard, because when you're passionate about your idea, whether it's sustainability, whether it's a new technology idea, whether it's a change to the way HR does a core function, right? You want to get to yes, and you want to get to yes now. But the reality is that if you haven't gauged your partner's readiness and you haven't gauged their priorities, it's going to be a fast no. So you really have to be sensitive. It's not about politics. It's really attuned to when it's time to push and when it's time to slow down. Because if you time that correctly, you actually go farther net than if you did just trying to jam that gas pedal down through the initiative.
I'm curious with this last point. Obviously, businesses and business cycles ebbs and flows.
Sure.
Lots of economic concern right now, worries that we might be moving into a recession. In your experience, at least there's a narrative often that CSOs and ESG, that they, when times are good, we're really interested, and when times are bad, it's the first thing to go. Is that right, or are there ways to make sure that ESG isn't the first victim of a cut when times are tough?
I would have said that 10 years ago, much more likely the case. I think today the answer is much less likely that ESG and sustainability is going to go. What I do think is being asked are, is this strategy aligned with the business priorities, right? So if you are an agricultural company, if you're making food products, yes, you should be thinking about organic farming. You should be thinking about soil quality. You should be thinking about labor rights and the issues of agricultural workers. Those may not be your top priority if you are a publisher or you're a telecommunications company. So I think where we see sustainability leaders today being asked is not cut everything, slash everything, but it's being asked, is this core to our business? And frankly, I think, Mike, it's a reasonable question to ask, right? Because when you're thinking about the core business, you're doing either one of the two or hopefully both ends of the spectrum that we talked about earlier, which is generating opportunities, generating revenue, or you're mitigating risk. If you're not doing either one of those, then you're probably doing employee volunteerism, which is important, mm-hmm. full stop, but that isn't necessarily the prime focus or the prime responsibility of a chief sustainability officer of a company of any size.
How do you balance what I might call more symbolic actions for more substantive actions? And especially if those symbolic actions maybe resonate better with some of your stakeholders, maybe your employees, maybe your customers. I know just one anecdote, you think about back many years ago now, BP, British Petroleum, and their whole campaign to be beyond petroleum, and they invested in alternative energy, mm-hmm. while simultaneously perhaps not paying quite enough attention to their operations, and then having one of the large or the largest oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico, where arguably, again, from a substantive standpoint, not having the oil spill far better than anything they were doing in the kind of beyond petroleum space. How do you manage those maybe tensions in that prioritization?
But tell me the tension, Mike. Is the tension that they did not invest? I mean, I think we all know the story here. Is the tension that they didn't invest in the operational and the EHS piece, or is it? Tell me more.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking more of if you, as you go through this process, you find that, hey, we can do something that might, from a life cycle analysis standpoint, not have maybe a huge impact, but it will resonate with our customers. It's a visible symbol of our commitment to these values, so we're rewarded for it, even though it might not really move the needle much on our actual footprint.
Listen, I am not a fan of marketing campaigns with no plan behind them. My recommendation to my clients, to any company, is if you don't have a credible plan behind it with dollars and resources, don't say it. Full stop. Having said that, there are partnership investments I think businesses should make that have zero immediate ROI, but actually have long-term benefits to them financially as well as on the E and the S. So the story I want to tell is the one where I created a partnership, a public-private partnership with the US EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to build out the multifamily Energy Star score. So, right, you're familiar with the little blue mm-hmm. Energy Star in your microwave. There's a 1 to 100 score for buildings, lots of building types, offices to churches to resorts. But over 10 years ago, there wasn't one for multifamily apartment buildings. So I reached out to the EPA. The EPA said, we don't have this rating because we don't have the data. And I said, let's solve it for you. And through a partnership with other organizations and Fannie Mae making an investment in the consulting company to pull in the data, we were able to give that to the EPA and create that 1 to 100 score for the entire nation to use. Now, thousands of buildings use this score. Zero financial benefit. Why would Fannie Mae care about this? Well, the reason for it is that now those buildings that report to Fannie Mae about their energy performance use the Energy Star score, and now Fannie Mae has a security, a green security, that it can tell investors, hey, we can also show you what the score is. That makes our security better. It makes it more transparent. So it ultimately had a long-term benefit for us financially by tapping into more green investors.
But you need to have that long view.
You have to have the long view. And I think that's the piece that's often difficult for us at any level in an organization to have, which is, how long am I going to stick it out? And Mike, if you don't mind, I'm going to touch on this. I was at Fannie Mae for over 10 years, which is a long time, especially when we think about changing jobs and how do we get our increases in salary and how do we get promotions. And oftentimes moving companies, you have to do that in order to get the pay. Just the statistics show it. I'm sure you've seen the data.
Yeah.
But I will say that there is something to be said for being inside an organization, understanding it as a leader, understanding what makes it tick, in order to start having some very sophisticated conversations about what are the long-term benefits, what are some of the levers that need to be pulled in order to get some really big changes done. If you're in and out of an organization in 6 months, in 18 months, you're probably not building up that political capital that you eventually need to spend to get some big yeses in place to make some big changes.
I think this is really relevant to another question we have online here, which is regard to the way I would interpret this here is that some of these solutions and technologies you might want to adopt are expensive.
Yeah.
Now, again, let's just for the sake of argument argue that they have that ROI, but just to get over the initial capital investment can be a challenge for organizations, especially when we're talking about things like the built environment where it might be a retrofit and things are working fine right now. We don't need to replace our boiler at this point. How do you justify those kind of large upfront expenses to motivate change?
You know, the large expenses, the CFO and the heads of companies make large investments all the time. And the reason why they say yes to them is because it aligns with the business goals. So if the technology that's being asked to come in doesn't align with the core business, it's a much harder road to go down to get to that yes. Where in our space, when we think about commitments to carbon reduction and we think about goals to be net zero by 2040, that does help get to a yes on some of these large conversations, but not always, and that's the truth. So I do urge everyone to think consistently about, is this really about carbon reduction, or is this about creating revenue opportunity, or is this about mitigating risk? If you can't answer those two, it's going to be very hard to get those big investments put into a company.
I'm glad you mentioned like net zero goals, and a lot of these, like you said, are, you know, 2030, 2040, 2050. Dare I say, most CEOs and boards who back these won't be really in place when they're coming out. So how do you avoid, in kind of the same vein, the risk of saying, all right, we've got this 2040 goal, but it's, you know, 2025, it's 2030, we still have time. Let the next person be the one who makes the big capital investment to make the transition.
So candidly, we don't have time. We don't have time, and the latest IPCC report points to that. The UN Secretary General said humanity is on thin ice. We don't have time. In fact, we need to accelerate. So I would say that the ways that we're going to get to the yeses in order to get to those big investments are, one, using our individual dollars, but that might seem small. How do I make personal choices? But they do matter. Two, it's actually influencing investors. The investors are the ones that are really driving the conversation, that are driving companies to make the investments. So I would argue is that we need to have more investors being interested in these issues, and they're growing, in order to have the companies get to yes so that we can accelerate. Without that, it's a little bit of a challenging situation, Mike.
Well, before we go down the path of, you know, depressing us all about, you know, how hard this is all to do, we have time for one last question. And so I'd just like to ask, for anyone here or online interested in getting into this space, and we talked before, you know, that could be a student, that could be someone, you know, maybe on the tail end of their career. What recommendation do you have on how to get, even just get started in this space?
Sure. Well, the reality is I actually believe that every job that everybody is sitting in today is a sustainability job. Whether you're in legal, you're in marketing, you're in HR, in sales, in IT, every single one has a way for you to turn the sustainability dial. And I mean environmental issues and social issues and governance issues. So thinking about how somebody in legal can change language that allows for investments to be made, or somebody in HR can be thinking about maternity benefits, paternity benefits, somebody who is working in IT can start thinking about their data centers. They don't have to be on the sustainability team. If you want to be on the sustainability team, I think today you do have to have deep expertise in at least one technical issue. You do have to understand carbon at a very deep technical level, or a social issue, biodiversity, for example, or human rights issues if you want to work in supply chains and human rights. So first point, Mike, is every job is a sustainability job in your seat today. And if you want to move and to be in that core sustainability team, start becoming a technical expert on one of those environmental or social governance issues so that you can be the person that can unlock that opportunity or that risk mitigation strategy for your company. That's how you're going to show value, and that's how you're going to be engaged in sustainability.
I think that's some great advice. Please join me in thanking Krisa for sharing her thoughts and being with us today. Thank you.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.